Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In this week's episode, we'll examine the U.S.-Mexican drug wars and look at the underworld of Los Zetas, that's the infamous drug cartel accused of gang brutality. We'll hear from Dan Slater, author of Wolf Boys. He's the former Wall Street Journal reporter. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Andrew Becker, reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I'm Andrew Becker, and it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. A lawyer-turned-writer, Dan Slater is a former legal affairs reporter for The Wall Street Journal and has written for The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, The Atlantic, GQ, and Fast Company. He is the author of Wolf Boys and Love in the Time of Algorithms. For those of you here tonight, please see the program flyer for his full biography. Please join me in welcoming Dan Slater for a conversation on Mexican drug cartels and their systemic recruitment of children into this dangerous industry. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming.
So, Dan, you've written a really a very compelling book, a fast-paced book, about two teenage boys who are friends who grow up really in a border town that is really kind of a crucial point for the drug trade in the United States. Tell us a little bit about how you came on to this story about these two boys.
It started in 2009. I'd recently been laid off from the Wall Street Journal, actually, and I was at home one June morning. I had just filed for unemployment insurance, and I got the New York Times off my stoop. And there was a story that day. It was actually in the national section. Usually the cartel pieces are in the international section, or they put them on the front. This was on the national section, and it was about two teenagers from a place called Laredo, Texas, which I really knew nothing about, who had become assassins for a very violent and vicious Mexican drug cartel that at the time had just started to get a lot of press up north for what was happening in Mexico. And it was one of those stories that you read and just don't forget. It scared me, it terrified me, and I couldn't get these boys out of my head. So that was the first that I learned of them. At the time, I didn't know if they were anomalies. I didn't know what they meant. I didn't really have a context for them. And so I started reading up on the cartel wars and on the history of the drug trade in Latin America. And I actually went down to Mexico with my father a few months later. And we didn't go to the Gulf side where the boys had operated with the Zetas. We went to the other side, the Sinaloa side, which is on the Pacific. If any of you have ever been to like Mazatlan, Mazatlan is south of the capital of Sinaloa, where the Sinaloa cartel operates. And on the outskirts of the capital city there's a famous cemetery that's known unofficially as the Cartel Cemetery. And so my father and I went to visit, the Cartel Cemetery. This was the closest that I could really get to anything. I was newly laid off as a legal reporter. I had been basically a desk reporter in New York for years, and I really didn't, know anyone in Mexico. So we go to the cemetery to try to see what we can see of the culture, the lifestyle, whatever. And on the sort of outskirts of the cemetery, you see these big mausoleums that are built by the families of the fallen cartel members, sort of the bosses, the people who are higher up. And they're very gaudy mausoleums that look almost like a condominium in Miami, but in miniature or something like that. And then we wandered into this field in the center that was the size of maybe a few football fields where all the plain headstones are. And walking amongst those headstones, I started noticing that most of the birth dates were around like 1990, and we were there in 2010. So most of these people were 18, 19, 20, 21 when they died. And it wasn't uncommon to see a headstone for someone who died when he was 13 or 14. And so I thought back to the boys I'd read about in Laredo who'd become assassins for the Zetas, and it occurred to me that they were not really unusual. They may be somewhat unusual here in America, but they weren't at all unusual in the drug war. And it sort of occurred to me that the way we'd been reading about the drug war in the paper, that, you know, the stories of vast wealth on the one hand, the horrifying violence on the other, was only partly right. But the drug war wasn't about the Chapo Guzmans and the heads of the cartels. It was really about boys slaughtering one another. So that was when I thought that if I were to write a book about the drug cartels, it really needed to be through the eyes of the youngsters rather than through someone else.
So give us a sense of kind of the setting of Laredo, Texas, mm-hmm. and its sort of sister city on the south side, Nuevo Laredo. And just give us a description of what life is like there and why is Laredo an important place?
Laredo is important for a lot of reasons. It's important to us as a country, and it was very important to the fates of these boys. It's the biggest overland port in the Western Hemisphere, for one thing, and that's partly thanks to NAFTA. The city sees about 60,000 semis move through a week, and so there's a lot of commerce there, but very little of that business winds up in the pockets of the working class. Most of the people who live there are impoverished. The poverty rate is something like 35% or 40%, and this is a city of 250,000 people. So there's a lot of poverty there. There is a huge black market because it's on the border. And it's not just drugs north, that's the way we usually think of it, but it's also things like weapons moving south to Mexico, vehicles moving south to Mexico. And so these boys living in the ghettos where they lived, it wasn't unusual for pretty much everyone who lived in these neighborhoods to be involved in some aspect of the black market. So they were raised, raised around this.
So who are these boys? What are their names, and how did you come to know them?
So the two lead boys and Wolf boys, the lead boy is Gabriel Cardona, and the other boy, who was a friend of his, is Bart Retta. Bart was a nickname. His actual name is Rosalio. And they were born into a ghetto that's right on the border. It's Las Tecas, the name of the ghetto. It's the oldest neighborhood in Laredo. And it's the neighborhood where Laredo was essentially founded in the 1750s. So it's always been a smuggling neighborhood for as long as Laredo has been a city. And it's just an extraordinary neighborhood. It's about 6 by 6 blocks. And you can literally walk out of your door and throw a stone into the Rio Grande. You could throw another stone onto the International Bridge that comes across. And you can throw a third stone to I-35, which begins right there. And it goes north-south and concludes in Duluth, Minnesota, 1,600 miles north. And it's a prized smuggling highway. And so this is why in 05, this kind of gets a little ahead of us, but this is why in 05, 06, when these boys were 16, 17, 18, there was a cartel war that spilled across into Laredo because both sides of Mexico were fighting for that I-35 pathway.
So these two boys, I mean, are they born into this life, or how do they come to become teenage assassins?
So the lead boy in the story, Gabriel, he was in a sense born into it because, A, he was born into poverty, and B, he was born into an extended family where a lot of people related to him, his father, his uncles, were in some aspect of smuggling. So he was around, for instance, immigrant smuggling from probably the age of 5. I mean, he'd walk out his door, he'd walk to his school, and he'd pass immigrant smugglers. He'd see narcotics being packed in his neighborhood for the drive north. So in that sense, he was born into an environment of it, but he also appeared to be moving away from that when he was younger. He was winning awards in math and English class. He was handsome. He was very talented. He was the quarterback of his middle school football team. And he had summer jobs, and he would give money to his mother, and he took a lot of pride in that. And when he had his freshman year of high school, he thought he was going to be the quarterback on the junior varsity football team. And when he was benched, that was a big hit to his ego. And he didn't really have anyone around in his family telling him to stick it out. So like a week into his freshman year of high school, he's 14, 15 years old. He just decides to walk off the team. When you're that age in Laredo and you stop having something to sort of occupy your time, the descent can be very quick. So within a matter of days, he was riding around with a street gang, smoking pot for the first time, vandalizing houses, and he got into taking pharmaceutical drugs that are very common in Laredo. They're called roaches. That's the name that the kids use. They're up here. We know them as roofies or the date rape drug. Used to be called the Spanish fly in the 70s and 80s back in the day. And they're no longer even available here. I don't know if they've ever been available. They're illegal here, but they're very easily obtainable across the border in Mexico. And it's a party pill for the youngsters there. So he developed a taste for this, which it's like Valium, but way, way stronger. And it was through taking these roofies or roaches that he was able to sort of get his start in the criminal world, because it took away all his inhibitions. He could walk into a parking lot at, say, a gas station, look for someone who left, the keys in the car when they go in to pay. He hops in the car. He drives the car a mile across the border into Mexico, and he sells it to someone. That was a very lucrative sideline for him. He and his friends began buying weapons from a Laredo cop who would sell them out of the back of the trunk of his cop car. He'd show the kids a law enforcement magazine, a catalog, and they would choose what they wanted, and he'd say, okay, come back in a week. And they would buy the weapons from the cop, and they would sell the weapons across. So there's a vast underworld in Laredo, and Gabriel had a hand in pretty much all aspects of it by the time he was 16.
And so family, I mean, where's a mother, a father? I mean, how representative is Gabriel's story in terms of growing up in this ghetto in Las Tecas?
It's, I don't want to say the norm, but it is sort of the norm. A lot of kids join a street gang and they have to be earners in some way. They have to add to the bottom line in some way. And there's a billion-dollar underworld that moves through that city. So a lot of youngsters are going to be in some aspect of it.
And to the gangs themselves. I mean, is that, in terms of the career progression, if you will, of someone like Gabriel or his friend Bart, starting off as a street gang, that's kind of, is that a farm league? I mean, how is that for the cartels? I mean, how do these kids get on the cartel's radar from there? From joining, running around, buying guns from a police officer out of his squad car to becoming an assassin. I mean, I can certainly understand with the parents. I mean, these are kids who end up becoming not just contributing members to the family income, but the primary breadwinners.
Absolutely, especially when you start working for an organization like the Zetas. But so before that happened, yes, the street gangs function as these sort of informal farm leagues. And I say informal because the way that Gabriel met the cartel in the spring of his 17th year, there was nothing formal about it. He and a friend had stolen, I think, a Jeep Cherokee one night, and they went across to Mexico to sell it to a cop in Mexico. When they show up at the police barracks, they are told that the cop isn't there. So they turn the truck around and they go to drive it back into Texas. And as they're driving back to the border, they get pulled over by a bunch of black SUVs. And they get detained. They don't know who these folks are. They get detained and they're taken to a ranch. And that was the first night that Gabriel met a man by the name of Miguel Trevino, who at the time in 2004 or so was sort of a mid-level boss in the Zetas. And Gabriel learned that the cop they had tried to sell the car to that night was actually working for the rival cartel. And so Miguel was about to kill him. And shortly before that was about to happen, Gabriel blurted out the name of a contact that he had, someone else he'd been selling vehicles to, who did happen to be sort of an associate of the Zetas. And so that saved them at the last minute. Within about a week, Gabriel was at a training camp for the Zetas in sort of deep Mexico, where he spent a couple months. And when he came out of the training camp, he was essentially a killer. And we can get into that later. But so that was the trajectory into the cartel for him.
So let's step back for a second. Who are the Zetas? Tell us what exactly, what does Zetas mean, and who are they? Where do they come from? And why, as a cartel, as a organized crime syndicate, mm-hmm. how are they different?
Well, we hear a lot about the corruption in Mexico and the cops working for the cartels, and it absolutely works that way. But it's hard to grasp the full extent of it until you learn about the Zetas, because they evolved from an elite military unit. It would be equivalent to like the Green Berets here in the U.S. deciding to become a drug cartel. This started happening in the mid and late 90s. And they became, there were a bunch of members of this unit. It was called the GAFE, which stood for Grupo Aeromóvil Fuerzas Especiales. And men from that unit began defecting and working for the Gulf cartel as the enforcers for the Gulf cartel, sort of the muscle. And eventually these guys evolved into their own drug cartel that worked alongside the Gulf cartel. And they called themselves the Zetas.
And that had to do with,
there are different stories on why they ended up calling themselves the Zetas, but
a call sign for
it could be it was a radio sign. It was a call sign. There was another story about how the man who ran the Gulf cartel, he had been poor as a child and he was fond of saying a man without shoes, cannot walk, or something like that. And so Z is Zapatos, which means shoes in Spanish. So he liked the Zetas. There are all kinds of explanations. But they started calling themselves the Zetas. They originated from a military unit, and they took on this sort of militant, take no prisoners philosophy. So they were very scary. They were a very scary organization. They became a ruthless organization, and they eventually came to dominate the eastern part of Mexico.
And from just to kind of give a sense of it, that went beyond just the drug trade. I mean, they literally were controlling various industries, or at least endeavoring to control different industries, and government as well, or at least law enforcement.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, after Gabriel started working for them as an assassin, the first jobs he did were in Mexico, and he was often assisted by the cops. I mean, the cops would set up an area for him, or he would need to go into a restaurant to kill a target, and they would, clear out the restaurant beforehand so the target was alone, or and then they would take the body away after. I mean, it's very, very disturbing stuff. So, yeah, they endeavored to take over law enforcement. They ran the immigrant business. They ran the cocaine business. They ran the marijuana business. They said that there would be no heroin or meth. That was where their morality kicked in. And I saw this during research when I went down to a city on the Gulf called Veracruz, which is, some of you may have been to, it's a beautiful city in a beautiful state in Mexico. It's rich, rich agriculturally. But if Mexico is a narco state, Veracruz is the capital. It's just corrupt up and down. And it's not just the drugs, as you say. I mean, it's the electronics that, arrive at the port, and everything is essentially under the control of the Zetas.
So give us again, put us in terms of a time frame now, where we are, where Gabriel has become, he's 17, or roughly around 17, when he first meets this Miguel Treviño, mm-hmm. who's at that point a mid-level cartel capo or boss.
Right.
He's not the boss of bosses quite yet. But there is tension that's rising within among the drug cartels in Mexico. And where does Gabriel kind of participate in these battles that are going on? And so give us kind of a time frame of where we are and where these fights are happening that he's involved in.
Mm-hmm. So the Zetas had essentially locked down Nuevo Laredo, which is the Mexican sister city across from Laredo, Texas. And they sort of controlled that I-35, the highway that went up through Texas. And what happened around 2003, 2004, is that they started to get a challenge from the Sinaloa cartel, who operates on the other side of the country. The border crossing into Laredo had become so lucrative that the Sinaloa cartel wanted to get in on it. And so this battle emerged between the two sides, and it pretty quickly spilled over into Texas. And so Gabriel and his friends really came along at the perfect time for the Zetas, because they found that, hey, these American boys could be very useful to us because they can fight the war for us in the States. Obviously, there were a lot of Mexican boys who worked for the cartel doing the same thing, but they weren't able to cross over freely. They didn't know both languages. They didn't know the cultures. I mean, if you passed Gabriel Cardona in an American mall, you wouldn't even notice him.
I mean, to distinguish a little bit between, say, Laredo and that side of Texas and that side, Nuevo Laredo, that side of Mexico with, say, Western Texas, mm-hmm. and a place like El Paso and Juarez. El Paso, which oftentimes crows the fact that it's the safest or second safest city in the country. Years later, on the flips, on the other side of the border, Juarez, which was one of the most dangerous places in the Western Hemisphere, where basically you go to church in El Paso and you take care of and you take care of all of your dirty laundry, whether that's your vices or your killing in Juarez. Different on the other side, where now you are you have these U.S. teenage boys that can cross back and forth either side, and they're taking care of some of the dirty business on the U.S. side.
Yes.
And that's a break, really, from how at least some of the other cartels, for the most part, had operated. Why did they start going in that direction? Was it because of the ability of these boys to go back and forth?
It was the ability of the boys to go back and forth. It was the fact that a boy will pretty much, especially a boy who comes from the sort of impoverished environments that these boys came from, will do anything for money. They're like these sort of heat-seeking missiles that you can point in any direction. And that's what Miguel Trevino did with them.
It's incredibly manipulative. I mean,
yeah.
The ability to, I mean, the extent of both exploiting these kids, but also kind of unleashing them and kind of the savage brutality mm-hmm. that they're both exposed to. But then in some of the cases, I mean, Miguel Trevino has a brutality that's distanced, that's kind of unto itself comparatively, but really kind of unleashing these kids and almost these kind of these teenage, you know, this teenage id kind of crystallized, kind of incarnate.
And I think that id was emboldened by the experience these kids had in Texas with the legal system, because one of the parts of the book that's incredible to me was just, you know, it was fascinating to learn, was that there were several times when Gabriel would get arrested for homicides. And he'd be brought in and he'd have an interrogation with the homicide detective, Robert Garcia, who's a character in the book. And he would sit there and he'd tell Robert all the stuff that he did in Mexico, all the crazy things he did in Mexico, because he knew that he couldn't be touched for anything that he did in Mexico. And then he would go to jail for a week or a couple months. And then Miguel Trevino would send an American attorney with a suitcase of money and bail him out. And Gabriel would immediately go right back to work. And so for a boy who already has no sense of consequence, to have that experience once and then to have it again, he became pretty certain that he could operate in Texas the same way that he operated in Mexico, until, of course, that was no longer the case. But
I mean, that just kind of speaks to this kind of vicious cycle of the war on drugs. And certainly under the Obama administration, there's been at least some movement away from using that terminology. Mm-hmm. Whether it's still been that or not. But speak a little bit about that, maybe from the perspective of someone like Robert Garcia, who has been both kind of a drug warrior, but also a homicide detective.
Yeah.
And kind of through his perspective and your own understanding and reporting, you know, just how this cycle of the drug war just perpetuates itself.
Well, Robert Garcia was not the initial inspiration for the book. The initial inspiration for the book for me was to learn about the lives of these boys who became the horrific things that they became. But the further I got into it and the more time I spent with Robert, the more I understood him to be sort of an equally fascinating person. He came from really even less than the boys did. He was actually born in Mexico, and he immigrated across to Eagle Pass, Texas with his family when he was 9. Literally built his own house with his father on a pile of dirt. They were completely self-made. His mom and dad are migrant farmers. He got a scholarship to college. He passed it up. He enlisted in the Army, where he met his wife. And they retired from the Army in their early 20s, and they settled in Laredo, where he became a street cop. This was in the 1990s. And he was doing a lot of drug investigations, a lot of drug arrests then, which is pretty much what you do when you're, you know, a cop in Laredo, Texas. And he was very, very good at it, and he believed in it because he felt like he was accomplishing something. He would arrest someone with heroin, and he was not only taking heroin off of, you know, out of the city, but he was arresting someone who would do other things to get the drugs, who would burglarize a home. And so he felt very good about this and very certain of what he was doing. And he did it so well that he was awarded Officer of the Year when he was 29, and he was tasked out to the federal DEA for many years. This is something that's kind of common in Laredo. There's this huge law enforcement complex there. Every local, state, and federal agency has a huge presence there. And so they're constantly trading employees. So you send someone to another agency, they get some sort of new view on things, they learn new things, then they come back. So he was sent off to DEA for several years, and it was in DEA that he suddenly got this sort of nationwide lens on the drug war, and it shocked him because he saw that the war on drugs was essentially, you know, accomplishing nothing because the interdiction rate was actually like 1% or less. So it was very easy as a local street cop to feel like you were accomplishing something. But when he saw how little was accomplished at the national level, he became very disillusioned. And so when he returned to the Laredo police force around the age of 34, 35, he decided to leave the drug investigations behind. And that's when he became a homicide detective, because he had this notion that, you know, even if he can't stop the drugs, there's something he can do about the violence, make his city safer. So it was in that capacity that he wound up pursuing the Wolf Boys at the time they became employees of the Zetas and the cartel wars began to come over into Texas.
I mean, it really offers an interesting window both with Garcia and some of the other DEA agents, who some of them very much, you know, true believers and are the drug warriors, maybe younger in their career and are looking always for a career case. I mean, there's really kind of that juxtaposition. And with it, you know, the fact that these are good guys who need these bad guys. The criminal justice system needs this input to keep the wheels spinning. And whether it's through the bail bond industry, as you talk about, or asset forfeiture, the seizures of automobiles, other conveyances, the cash, the money, and the budget that go with it from Congress.
I mean, we think about Laredo as sort of, and it is a marginalized city, and it is unique in some ways, but in some ways it's very much like other American cities, Chicago, you know, Detroit, New York, Baltimore, and that a huge segment of its economy relies on crime. And so one of the misconceptions about the war on drugs and the cartel wars is that it's all about the corruption in Mexico. But in fact, there's a form of that going on here because it's such a lucrative war for us as well. And it's also, as I think you mentioned, it's a self-financing war with asset forfeitures and with asset seizures. And when you have a self-financing war, you don't have many politicians who want to give that up because there isn't any reason to. So we've gotten ourselves into kind of a pickle that way because so many jobs rely on it. And it's not just the obvious jobs. I mean, it's law enforcement, you know, of course. But there's all these related industries that we don't even necessarily think about. It's the prosecutors, it's the defense attorneys, the bail bond industry, which is enormous. It's in Laredo, it's the people who own the warehouses who rent out this warehouse space to the government because the government seizes all this contraband and then they need a place to store it. The list of beneficiaries goes on and on.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Dan Slater. He's the author of Wolf Boys, and he's a former Wall Street Journal reporter. He's in conversation with Andrew Becker of the Center for Investigative Reporting. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. So visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to their conversation.
So ultimately, what happens with Gabriel and his friend Bart? What's their fate? And what have they learned from all of this? I mean, these are two teenage boys who are literally going around and having, frankly, a great time killing people.
Yeah.
It's almost like a video game of sorts. How does this kind of sit with them now, and what are the takeaways?
I think the boys are different. I think Gabriel and Bart are different. I think that Bart did enjoy it. I mean, he said he enjoyed it many, many times. I don't think Gabriel enjoyed what he was doing. And I think that's why Gabriel relied so heavily on the tranquilizers. What he did like is the money and what the money did.
And the power.
And the power and the sense of belonging and being able to give more money to his mother in a week or two than she made in 6 months or a year. In Laredo, that's a huge piece of male identity, to be able to support your family. There's a sort of supporting wolf boy in the book. His name is Richard Hosso. He started smuggling immigrants with his grandmother when he was six. And by the time he was eight, he was smuggling coke with his dad. And by the time he was 15, he had his own operation. By the time he was 17, he was making about $30,000 a week. And he gave most of that to his family. Everyone was driving a new car, and he'd go to Toys R Us and get his kids $6,000 worth of stuff, and it was no big deal. So it's big, big money, and it's also a sense of belonging and a sense that your life has meaning because you can provide for others. I think that for Gabriel, for many other the boys in the book, that was probably the biggest allure.
With the telling of this if story and kind of ultimately their arrest, Gabriel is arrested. Bart is arrested in Mexico.
Yeah.
He basically kind of goes off on his own or disobeys orders come from the cartel higher-ups, and ultimately he loses any kind of cartel protection, and he gets caught. Gabriel is a different situation where he's literally in a house getting ready to go out and assassinate somebody, right? Making preparations when what happens?
Do I just give away the ending?
No, maybe not. We'll let them do that. But
eventually things don't go well for the boys, and they wind up in prison. And we kind of know that because I was able to write the book and I had access to them. So we know they're still alive. And I eventually reached out to them. and that's how, I'm not answering anything you ask right now, but I'm trying to avoid giving the ending away for anyone who actually cares to read the book.
I mean, there is the opening of the book gives a little sense.
Yeah, the prologue of the book sets up the ending a little bit. It kind of places you toward the end of the book, so you have a sense of what's going to happen.
But from there, so what happens then is this is really kind of a precursor to what happens, which has gotten a lot of attention, obviously, in the 10 years, give or take, since the Mexican really kind of government accelerating and really going all out in its battles against the different cartels.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, certainly the disappeared and these kind of ghost stories and traveling up and down the border as you have, as I have, and hearing these stories of of the youth on both sides of the border, like you were saying, with these fields of graves. Mm-hmm. Same thing in other parts of the border in the United States or on the border as well. These stories of the disappeared. Is there, and with it, probably some of the people that perhaps even Gabriel and Bart targeted. What's the coda? You know, what has happened with the Zeta since, in the 10 years since the story kind of wraps up, at least with Gabriel and Bart, mm-hmm. and kind of what's the direction from here in terms of the Zeta as an organization, but also how the U.S. and Mexico are endeavoring to fight these organized crime groups?
Well, I think the way the U.S. and Mexico has gotten together on this is with the kingpin strategy, trying to go after the bosses. And that's a very good media strategy because it makes good headlines when you arrest a boss. When you arrest a kid, no one really cares. It winds up in the back of the newspaper, which is where I found the story about these boys. But when you get a kingpin, you get headlines, and law enforcement agencies like that. The problem with that strategy is when you take out the bosses, you create a power vacuum as you would anywhere else, and that's when the violence gets the worst. So this is the argument for having someone like Chapo Guzman, which is he was leader of the Sinaloa cartel, and he's been in the news a lot in the last year because he escapes and he gets arrested, and he builds a tunnel out of his cell, and it's movie-ready, the stories. And people love to read about that. I love to read about it. But there's a very good argument for why we might want to leave someone like that out, because there's much less violence when he's out of prison. And in fact, what's happening with the Zetas right now on the other side of Mexico is that things have just gotten a lot better, relatively better recently, because the person who had been running the cartel for a long time was recently let out of prison, and now he's back in command and instituting rule. And this is just the reality we face. We have a huge demand for drugs here, and yet we have the war on drugs. So there's always going to be the schism between reality and what the ideals we hope to achieve through the policies we institute. And as long as there is a schism between those things, we're going to have to to put up with this, or Mexico is going to have to put up with it, but increasingly it spills over into the U.S., so it's our issue too.
Well, at this point, we've been collecting some of your questions, and I'd like to bring them into our conversation now. So kind of pivoting off of that last point about the coda and really kind of the strategy, what do you think can be done between the U.S. and Mexico to either continue to work efficiently or to work more effectively to address this? Is this another way of asking this? Do we need to rethink, or how should we rethink our war on drugs to becoming more as originally it was approached as a public health concern? Or does this strategy of continuing to be militaristic in going after the cartels, at least, is that the right way to keep going? What do you see?
I think it comes down to a bunch of things. One of the problems I see is that we tend to talk about drug and drug war policy in a silo. So the legalization discussion and other discussions like sentencing reform, those are really important, but they don't exist alone. It's all part of a system, and in a place like Laredo, Texas, or in places in Montana where you have a lot of cartel members, or a place like Chicago, it's about poverty, and it's about failure of this country to bring marginalized communities into the fold better, providing jobs, putting policies in place that help to keep families together more. So as sort of cliched and soapboxy as that sounds, I think we need to look at it as a whole. And certainly looking at addiction as a public health issue, needle exchanges, legalization, yeah, but certainly with marijuana, maybe eventually with cocaine, but are we going to legalize heroin? I mean, heroin is the devil. I just don't see how that can happen. As far as how we fight the war, I think we need to acknowledge that until we legalize everything, you're going to have organizations in Mexico that are going to serve the black market. That's always been the case. And so we have to think about how do we make that, you know, the safest? How do we wreak the least havoc? And is it not arresting the bosses? I mean, that's shown to be very effective, but then it's like you give a free pass to the most vicious, violent people who rise to the top. And the prize is that once you become the most vicious, then you're off limits and you're free to do as you want. It's hard to imagine a world that in which that would work either. So, but
in fact, that's how it has played out with a number of these kingpins. I mean, mm-hmm. the former head of the Gulf Cartel, who in fact, helped create the Zetas.
Yeah.
I mean, he eventually made a deal with the U.S. government, and his sentence is considerably less than what
he'll be out in 2025. Yeah, he was arrested in Mexico in 2003. He was extradited to the States in 2007. There was a trial. It was closed doors. There was no information that came out of that trial. And the public narrative was that he got a 25-year sentence, which, given what he did, is nothing. But it wasn't even 25 years. If you go on the federal inmate locator site, you'll see that he's scheduled to get out in 2025. And so he went in 2010 or something, or maybe he's, you know, extradited in 07. So really, what did he get? He's maybe serving 15 or 18 years or something. And he was the guy that created the Zetas. And so this is another theme you see, is that the capos do get less time, and the foot soldiers, the boys like Gabriel Cardona and Bart Retta, they end up serving life sentences. And the rationale behind that is that the bosses have information to get up when they get arrested, when they're extradited. They have information to give up about smuggling routes, about where to find other bosses, about where to find their rivals. And
how much money they'll give up.
Well, there's also, it also seems that when OCL Cardenas, who was the boss that I was just talking about, who's going to be out in 2025.
Whose nickname was the friend killer.
And it actually came up in a trial. One of his former bodyguards said that when he was extradited, they sent $60 million to him to negotiate with. Nobody knows where that money ended up, but he might have.
So speaking of, so kind of pivoting off of the violence issue, I mean, and a part that you touched on a little bit, and that is so much of, and this kind of goes back and forth with the two countries and their governments for years, pointing fingers, and the U.S. being accusatory of Mexico's corruption and looking the other way and allowing, in managing, really, refereeing even the cartels, mm-hmm. and perhaps even benefiting when you had the PRI in power, as they were for, you know, seven decades or so. That on the flip side, it's been the Mexican government, and certainly there's been under the Calderon, with the PAN, with the change in political parties in power in Mexico, there was definitely a warming between the two countries to an extent. But for years it was, well, it's your demand. And increasingly, in recent years, it had been, it's your weapons. It's your U.S. guns flowing south that are contributing to this violence. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, can you discuss how U.S. gun laws may have contributed or how they've contributed to the cartel violence? And I think you talk a little bit about it in terms of, one, just buying weapons out of the back of a Laredo police officer squad car, or even the value of smuggling weapons into Mexico.
A lot of American smugglers who deal with the cartel like the Zetas, they actually trade weapons for their drugs. They can basically, you know, make an upstart organization without actual money. They just go down there with a bunch of weapons, and they get, in exchange, they get a drug load for it. Weapons have just become so plentiful in this country. States like North and South Carolina, states like Texas, it's so easy to get a gun, and they're in such high demand in Mexico. So that's become a form of currency.
Really. I mean, and yet what's interesting is in Mexico, it's and you see this when you cross south into, you're driving south into Mexico, often there's the big green signs, billboards saying that it's illegal to have weapons in Mexico.
Yep. And yet it is illegal. It's illegal to own a weapon in Mexico.
So how does that work?
Well, how it works is everything is for sale, and there's no it's this giant zone of impunity. And for someone like Gabriel, where you know, that's where you get trained, that's where you get your start, you learn this rule of impunity, and then you come over here. And in some ways it's similar over here, in some ways it's not.
That impunity. In understanding the Zetas and how they grew to the extent that they did and were as fearsome as they were, there was certainly the brutal violence and the extortion and really being almost indiscriminate in who they targeted. I mean, they were going after, there would be a new police chief and the next day they would kill him. Mm-hmm. Or they were throwing grenades or trying to bomb the newspapers, or at least intimidating journalists.
A lot of journalists died, yeah.
A lot of journalists mm-hmm. died. What about just the traditional way of the other side of that equation? In Mexico, it's the plato o plomo. It's the silver or lead. How did they work in the more, say, traditional organized crime way of paying off the police or paying off politicians that enabled them to grow to the extent that they did? Was that a strategy, or is it simply...
Absolutely, yeah. You buy a governor, you pay for the campaign, and you put your governor in place. This was happening in Veracruz. You put, you know, your journalists in place. If journalism doesn't pay much money here in the States, it pays even less there. Maybe if you work at a newspaper, maybe you're making $100 a week. Probably not even. And so you're getting supplemented by someone. Sometimes it's a cartel. Sometimes it's a politician. But every person of significance in Mexico, politicians, businessmen, usually has a reporter at a newspaper, radio station, or on the TV working for them, basically being their mouthpiece. So the corruption is vast, and the Zetas sort of owned everything. I mean, even the utilities are, you know, corrupt. The guy who, sells your electricity, the guy who sells your water, the whole thing is bought off. So
the phone company, yeah. Everything. Now, how high does that corruption go with the Zetas? I mean, is there a sense of that, that you have from your reporting and touching on that in the book? I mean,
I think it could go all the way to the president. I know that Miguel Trevino in the end of 2006, when Felipe Calderon became the president of Mexico, Miguel Trevino thought that they were going to own him. They had allegedly made a payment to someone, and he was very upset when he found out that, according to him, Felipe was owned by the other side. So who knows if that's true, because Felipe Calderon launched a big war against the cartels. So it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and it's hard to tell what's actually going on. But I would say the corruption's the rule, and how high it goes is anyone's guess.
And then, but with that, I mean, the speculation in Mexico for years was the fact that there had been, part of that strategy was to go after a particular cartel, and that was to go after the opponents of the Sinaloa cartel. Mm-hmm. And was there a sense, I mean, did the Zetas feel that as well, as if they were being unfairly targeted by the government?
I think they did on sort of a situational level. There were times when they felt like someone that they'd paid off was not providing in exchange the services that the cartel had bought from the politician or from the prosecutor, and that person would be threatened or killed.
Going from Los Pinos, the Mexican White House, back down to Gabriel and to Bart, what lessons are there, or what is there a recipe, you think? Can you talk a little bit more about that in terms of how to prevent going forward, how to prevent you know, our youth from getting lured into these lives that, that end up devastating, I mean, annihilating, you know, large numbers of people while destroying their own individual lives.
One of the more interesting conversations I had in Laredo when I was down there, I went to see the principal of Gabriel's high school. And he's a guy who's very upfront. And one of the things he said to me was that he sees himself as sort of overseeing two different populations of the high school. He oversees the population of people who will go into the drug business and the population of people who will chase them. And so that's your principal. I mean, that he's supposed to be the optimistic person in your community, and that's the way he sees it. So, you know, a city like Laredo, again, similar to lots of American cities in its marginalization. The education system is horrible. The poverty is horrible. And I think unless and until we can get those things back on track, it almost doesn't make a lot of sense to focus too much on drug policy. That's my own opinion. A lot of people probably disagree with me. But
so it really comes down to just dealing with the basic social issues.
Mm-hmm.
You improve the education. You improve the job markets. But with a situation with NAFTA having been, and you talk a little bit about this, I mean, NAFTA helped create basically, certainly the applicants, right, the pool of potential people to go into this world because of the people that it brought to the border from the interior of Mexico. And with that, not necessarily the ability to kind of rise above or rise out of poverty. Is there anything else you think from a kind of a more geopolitical or policies between the two countries that can facilitate this at all? And some of that might be just Mexico dealing with its own kind of underclass or its own education system.
Yeah, I mean, not to short you too much on the answer, but I think that's it.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can tell us, I mean, with that, I mean, the way you engaged with them was often through writing them back mm-hmm. and forth, and there'd be times where you might not hear from one of them for a while. Can you just walk us through your reporting process a little bit
sure.
in terms of how did you manage to persuade these boys to tell you really what is their full story?
So in the summer of 2013, when Miguel Trevino, the cartel boss, was arrested in Mexico, I saw the news and I wondered if those boys who I'd remembered from 2009 reading about, who really had never left my mind, I wondered if maybe their boss's arrest would have some kind of favorable impact on their willingness to open up to a writer about their lives. So that's when I reached out to them, and I visited both Bart and Gabriel in prison, and I just said, look, I'm an author. I don't know where this would go, but I'd like to write about you in some way. Can we start sending letters back and forth? And they were both open to that. My letters with Bart, the younger one, went on for several months, and then it sort of fizzled out. He tended to see life as a chess game. Everything was a game, and you look down the board and try to figure out where the other person is going. And as a journalist or writer, when you're trying to understand the life of a subject, it's very hard to deal with someone who sees everything as a game. You kind of want all of the pretense to drop away, and he was really never kind of willing to just open up. So that's why the correspondence sort of stopped with him. But I had a much different experience with Gabriel. I have a couple of lines from the first letter that he sent me. He said, this is after I visited him. We spent about 8 hours together in prison. I went home. I sent him a letter, and he said, I do not mind sharing my life story, Dan. I don't pretend to be someone I'm not, but some media people have approached me with lies. And he had dealt with media people. He'd had an article written about him in Esquire magazine. He'd had an article written about him in Details magazine. He'd done a segment on CNN. And he didn't like how these reporters would approach him and say, I want to send a message to the kids out there about the consequences of the cartel life. And then they'd go off and they'd write about only about the, you know, the sensational aspects of it. And so he was kind of sick of that. He said, wrote to me, said, "You come across as honest and are a likable guy. We'll see where it leads on your project." So that was sort of a challenge to me, I guess a subtle challenge or a not-so-subtle challenge, essentially saying, you know, I'll answer whatever you want, and then the responsibility is yours. So he and I then embarked on this long letter-writing relationship, lasted for, well, it's really still going on, but for the book, it lasted for a couple years. Our letters stretched to about 1,000 pages, and you know, as Andrew said, it would, and I, you know, I talk about this at the end of the book. It was kind of like a long distance relationship. You know, it's sometimes on the rocks and misunderstandings, little spats that we had to get over. And then I also started going to Laredo, Texas a lot, and it was there that I'd hang out with his old associates, his family members, his mother, his brother, and also all the law enforcement people. Robert Garcia, the homicide detective. The U.S. attorney, the prosecutor who did the case against all these boys, and so forth. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of the work.
I'm wondering if we can go back and kind of a final thought, and the idea of the title of the book, Wolf Boys, where you got that idea from, or that title from. Is that something, is that how, you know, these kids are referred to? And kind of what that, you know, kind of going forward, you know, are there any other ideas, or what do we do to, I guess, diminish that kind of that wolf boy culture?
Well, the term wolf boys was my phrase, but it was inspired by what the boys were actually known as. So the Zetas would call their bosses, would have Z and then a number. So if you were like, for instance, Miguel was Z40. But if you were lower down, like a foot soldier, one of the, you know, the boys, you were called an LA, so like L 12, L 40, and L was for lobo, which means wolf in Spanish. And when I was working on the book, I randomly took Lord of the Flies off the shelf, like the book everyone reads in ninth grade, and I was reading Lord of the Flies kind of randomly, and I started thinking about this story through that Lord of the Flies lens, and kind of boys on an island, boys alone, boys without any oversight, who then turn against each other, which is really what the cartel wars are sort of, you know, about. And so that was when L.A., Lobo, Wolf Boys sort of occurred to me. As far as what we can do to kind of diminish this phenomenon, where it exists around the country, I mean, it's about opportunity, it's about family, it's about the economy and jobs, and we need to have a society that's more equal.
Well, that is all the time we have for tonight. On behalf of World Affairs, I ask you to join me in thanking Dan Slater for this excellent discussion. If you'd like to read more about this, Dan's book, Wolf Boys, is available tonight, and he will be signing copies here on stage. Many thanks as well to you, the audience, for your terrific questions. Thank you again, Dan, and Thanks. Good night.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Dan Slater. He's the author of Wolf Boys and a former Wall Street Journal reporter. He was in conversation with Andrew Becker of the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode or to register for an upcoming event or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Rob Spate. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.